JG 1. Number 4B.
Then I have to just pick out points here and there. Everything seems to be always interesting in the book, but here at now at the first chapter called The Blueprint for a Universe, the chapter first picks up this point of the origin of things. And here he shows and says that the central question to his book and what the quantum physicists are interested in is, what is the source of the universe creative power? That's their main concern today. What is the initial condition of the universe? What was that initial condition before the Big Bang? That's what they want to know. They know now that the Big Bang happened more or less, and that we have a universe that is expanding at an exponential rate, but that also may be contracting at the same kind of a rate as it is expanding outward. It may be also going inward towards a big crunch. We'll talk about that concept also. But they see then that the prime question is, what is the source or the initial condition of the universe's creative potency? After what went on before the Big Bang. They ask, how can the universe, having come into being subsequently, bring into existence totally new things by following the laws of nature? Not only do they want to know that initial condition or the origin or source of all things before the Big Bang, they also then are interested that after the universe has come into being, how can it subsequently bring into existence even again new things following the laws of nature? So therefore, in general, what is the source of creativity? Again, keep that melody of the model of being humming in our consciousness, and always thinking, does it show us what that source is? It does. And the next big question, he says, how does organization and complexity arise in nature? Oh my, one can't help but suddenly seeing, all right, either if we're looking at it from the standpoint of the synonyms, we can see mind as that creative source of the universe, and spirit as that which is evolving things towards higher and higher complexity. Or looking at it from the levels itself, we can always see that out of science itself, that that matrix of infinity suddenly explodes out of that matrix of infinity, the womb, like a big bang, comes our divine origin in divine science. It just comes right out of God. You see, it's from God, from that infinite one. We come spontaneously into being through those self-organizing laws of divine science, always bringing out greater and greater complexity. So just then listening again to this melody, he says, in recent years, much attention has been given to the problem of the so-called origin of the universe, and popular science books on the creation abound. He says, the impression is gained that the universe was created all at once in the Big Bang. It is becoming increasingly clear, however, that creation is really a continuing process, that the existence of the universe is not explained by the Big Bang, the primeval explosion, but that the Big Bang merely started things off. So again, it's that point. The universe looks like it came into being by the Big Bang, but then they say that creativity is a continual process, as he said. Things continue to be created. And what are those laws behind that creation? So with that in mind, just looking at these two points then, that what is the source of the origin of the universe? How is it evolving towards higher and higher complexity? We then see another point that he's asking. in talking about concerning the origin question. He said, and then actually they're talking about physical processes. He asked, by what physical process did the universe come into existence? And he answers it by saying, by a self-creating process. That origin of the universe from the Big Bang onward is a self-creating process. He calls it a quantum process. The universe came into existence spontaneously from nothing as a result of a quantum process. Therefore, he calls it a self-creating universe. And this is what they're excited about today. Even Karl Popper, he quotes in his book as Karl Popper saying, the greatest riddle of cosmology may well be that the universe, in a sense, is creative. Gosh, you see, that's that point about where we always thought man was that which was the creator and causing things to happen in so many instances. Not only then do they ask about a self-creative universe, but they're also seeing that it's a self-organizing universe. Once the universe has brought these elements and forces into being, that they begin to organize themselves spontaneously and in a non-linear way. Therefore, we have these books, one called The Self-Organizing Universe. In it, it says, we may one day perhaps understand the self-organizing processes of a universe which is not determined by the blind selection of initial condition, but as a potential of partial self-determination. Therefore, the concepts we're getting out of Davies' books is that we have a universe that has exploded forward through a self-creating process according to a self-creating universe, but also a self-organizing universe, a universe that can organize the higher and higher complexity that is coming into being, organizing it according to diversification, classification, and individualization. Then another big point that these scientists are seeing that we need to see in relationship to how the model of being is a science of all sciences. They talk then about the whole and its part. Davies goes on in the book, and under this title, The Whole and the Part, he says that the universe forms a coherent whole in peaceful coexistence. He says order and harmony and unity in nature exists, where chaos and discord might have been. Now, we know, and he shows us, that this concept of a holistic universe goes back to the Aristotelian world of Aristotle. That it isn't something that is just happening now. It's in vogue now, let's say. So many of these concepts we know can be traced back to their origin in the Greek. And here we see that he shows us that Aristotle's philosophy actually was one of holism and holistic harmony. That Aristotle himself actually proposed a universe which was synthetic or in synchronicity and purposeful. That Aristotle, he says, formed a picture of the universe from an intuitive feeling that there was teleology, final causation, or what he would call a finalism at work. That there was, it was goal-directed, a purposeful universe. That there was a global plan behind everything. So Aristotle said that the component parts and functions of the universe operated in a cooperative way to achieve this final purpose. And that everything behaved as a coherent whole, because he said there exists a full and perfect idea of an entire organism before it developed. gosh, one just can't help but hear our subject there, how the idea is already in the realm of perfection. That's certainly the eighth day of science itself in the Bible, where we see that tone of the eighth day, Genesis 2, 4, and 5, where the seed was in the ground before it grew. They see then, Aristotle saw that and said that this whole perfect idea of the entire organism was there before it developed. And he even extended this theory to the whole cosmos as a whole. And this then is what Davies says that he then calls a cosmic blueprint. Now, diametrically opposed to Aristotle, and we hear now that holistic theory is what we call new and modern, but that was already seen by Aristotle. And they say that the new paradigm is going against the Newtonian paradigm of the clockwork universe, which is a mechanistic universe, which is a reductionistic universe, which is a material universe, which is an atomistic universe. Well, poor Newton can't be blamed for everything. Though we just take the immediate past, and because Newton supported the atomistic, reductionistic, materialistic, mechanistic view of the world, he wasn't the origin. This is just, certainly we can even see it back at the time of Greeks. Davies shows us, and as we know, that the Greek atomists were in direct opposition to Aristotle, that they were working with this atomistic, reductionistic, materialistic view of the world. One of them was our friend Democritus, that we know from our study of philosophy. And to Democritus, the world was nothing but atoms moving in a void. And this is the old mechanistic view of the sciences that we were born into, the Newtonian view. That the world was nothing but atoms moving in a void, and that causes that bring about change are those that were produced by the shape and rearrangements by atoms alone. Because atoms restructured themselves, we had change. There's nothing in here about a grand mover or a telefinalistic cause or a metaphysical information source causing a change to happen, causing newness to happen. But the only thing that happened was because atoms were changing around that this brought about change. So Democritus, we lived in a universe which was a machine. And that, he said, each atom moves under the action of blind forces produced by its neighbor. Because the neighbor was moving around, it was that which was moving the individual atom. Therefore, teleologic and final causes, as I said, were dismissed as mystical. So this atomism and reductionism, this is just a big thing that the sciences are going after today. The atomistic, reductionistic, materialistic view of the world reduces everything to simple mechanical activity of the movement of these elementary particles. So this conflict that we are seeing today between the old science and the new science, as the new science moves forward, leaving the old science behind, Davies shows was already a conflict between the holism of Aristotle and the reductionism of Democritus. Therefore, he gives a nice, simple explanation then of reductionism, just saying that the scientific method or paradigm that was at work at the time of Newton was then based on analysis and reduction. That was taking everything and reducing it to its simple elementary particle. And that all physical phenomena and living organisms were purely complex machines reduced to the mechanical behavior programmed at a molecular level by their elementary constituents. It's the nothing but universe, huh? That clockwork universe. And this came to represent the scientific approach to the world. But today we see that view that is called the Newtonian view are actually also looking for the reduction of the universe to its basic elements and parts and atoms, and then those parts becoming fields and then forces. We can see that going against that then is the trend to move more and more towards the Aristotelian view of the world, that synthesis view, the synthetic or holistic approach, where they really see that the whole isn't equal to the sum of its part, as that reductionistic, mechanistic view shows. In a mechanistic universe, the whole is equal to this part plus this part plus this part plus this part makes a whole. It's like a machine. A machine is made up of its parts. But in the new holistic approach, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. They see that because the whole is a whole of relationships. And it's those relationships that make the whole greater than the sum of its parts. Just as if that example of taking a watch and disassembling a watch and putting all the parts of a watch on a table. Now, if we just put all the parts back together in any way we wanted, the watch may not work. It may not give off that tick, tick, tick. It's when all those parts are put together within a meaning relationship within the whole called watch, we get the tick, tick. And it's that tick, tick, which is that which is greater than the sum of its parts. When all the parts are working together, they give off something more than just what they are as parts. They give off a tick. So the Democritus view, and every lecture that we go to now in this quantum physics, even in this any of the books, everything is always going to refer us back to this point of Newton now. Of course, as we see, is the rebirth really of the Democritus view of reductionism. They're all talk about now how the new age physics is going against the Newtonian view. Certainly not throwing the Newtonian view out of the picture. It worked, that clockwork universe, thank goodness that we had it. Because we certainly needed to take the whole and reduce it down to its parts so we could see what was going on. That's reductionistic view. That's that method of analysis in science. But they see today science not only as a method of analysis, but it also has another arm, which is the method of synthesis, taking the part and putting it all back together again, so you get that universal tick, 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 tick. Now, Newton, which had that mechanistic view of the world, reducing everything down to its parts, he also had something that's important for us to know in a general way. He also brought forth these laws of motion. This is an interesting concept, and we're only going to not want to be experts on all this physics, but we just want to get a feel of it. That along in the 17th century, Galileo and Newton, and especially Newton's laws of motion, were formulated. And Newton did this in his book Principia in 1687. And just in a general way, he had these three laws of motion which were governing material bodies, and he put them in the form of mathematical equation. And he said that the motion of a body through space is determined by the forces that act on the body. So along with these laws of motion, he says that the motion of the body was determined by forces that are acting on the body. And one of those forces he called the gravitational force. You know how he dropped the apple from the tree and it fell down? Something was pulling it down, and therefore he talked then about the gravitational force. And he could show then that this gravitational force was at work, determining the way an apple falls from the tree, determining the path of a bullet, determining the planets around the sun. And so he showed that his laws of motion were universal laws. Now, this is interesting to us insofar as these laws of motion to Newton are laws which are reversible. A law to Newton, let's take a look at that here on one of these currencies. These laws of motion or time, the Newtonian time, are reversible. That means to the laws of motion, it doesn't matter whether you go time forward or time backward. They're all valid to the laws of motion. Just like when we have this tape recorder here. I can fast forward it or I can make it go back again. That's the law of motion. To those laws, it's just as valid for me to go forward and push the fast forward button as it is for me to push the reverse button, you see. It all makes sense to those laws. So the arrow of time to the Newtonian laws of motion can point in either direction. But we have a little bit of trouble with this when we see that time is irreversible to our standpoint of observation. We don't know quite what to do with an arrow that goes forward and an arrow that goes backwards. But the model being is going to tell us what to do with this also. But this is what these problems they're struggling with. To our time sense, everything has to either go one way or the other. It can't be such that time is reversible. And this is how Davies talks about it. He says, from our standpoint, such a reverse sequence is impossible. He says, because most physical processes that occur in the real world are irreversible. For example, to unbreak an egg, to grow younger, a river to flow uphill, to unstir milk from tea. And yet, we will begin to see that this point becomes resolved. So we have now this sense of these arrows of time. Let's see, I'm just looking for this one here, 8. All right, so if time can go either way, what they call the pessimistic arrow of time, is really then that arrow, which they call then the arrow of the second law of thermodynamics. That's that entropy that Dunui was talking about. That's that law of second dynamics where everything in the universe is supposed to be going more and more towards a state of equilibrium and a heat death. Huh? Things come to a state of equilibrium and degeneration and death. So we have an arrow pointing backwards, so to speak, going in reverse in thermodynamics according to the laws of entropy. That is an irreversible order that goes towards death. It cannot be reversed according to the laws. But at the same time, they're also seeing, as Dunui showed us, there is this optimistic arrow of time where things not only that goes against this law of second dynamics, which says that everything goes towards greater and greater simplicity and a heat death, there is another arrow that they call the optimistic arrow, which is going towards greater and greater complexity. And the question is, how do you resolve these two arrows? One is going towards a heat death and simplicity, and the other is going towards greater and greater complexity.